Welcome to another episode of Off the Menu. I'm your host, Vincent Franchini from Tumblr House, here with a polarizing Charles Coulombe.
Polarizing?
Yeah.
Polarizing?
Yes.
You mean as in separating people into different camps?
Yeah, you're a divider, not a uniter.
Well, that's not true.
You make people hate each other.
That is not true. I bring people together. Oh, you don't think so?
No.
All right. I've got a series of affirmations that will prove you wrong, smart guy.
Okay, let's see.
All right. Warmth is nice. I really like it, you know, when my feet are dry and I'm wearing comfortable shoes.
Yeah?
Yeah. I like tasty food.
See, you never talked like this before, see?
You know, yeah, but I've never been locked down for weeks before. And I've seen the need to bring people together. Life can be one enormous mattress. A feather down bed of unity. Everyone pulling together under the same deep quilt. It's a fluffed up pillows in a warm four-poster bed of existence. Everyone can dream together and be one and united in a cocoon of safety and health and happiness. There's no need for argumentation or conflict or discord. Everyone can basically think the same thoughts and have the same feelings and march according to the same lockstep.
I feel like that's an audio representation of your saccharin memes.
My saccharin memes.
I don't know, whatever you post, unicorns and bunnies and princesses.
Okay,
and
let me repeat that this is Easter. And this is a time when we should be turning our thoughts toward bunnies and chocolate eggs and ducklings and puppies and kittens and little chicks. And we should be thinking of tulips and flowers and lying in the green grass and listening to the brook babbling by our sides. This is a time when marshmallows should be the biggest thing on our minds right now. And I think that all of us really are wonderful people, all doing wonderful things in our own special way, just like everyone else. It's beautiful. And I can feel as I sit here.
Okay, stop. Just stop.
What? Just stop. Now who's being polarizing?
Maybe I should have introduced you as the sadistic Charles Coulombe, because that's more
sadistic.
Like
sadistic?
Yeah.
Sadistic?
That's right.
How can you call me sadistic? I'm bringing people together. I'm building bridges of understanding.
You're waterboarding us, except instead of waterboarding, it's this marshmallowy, sugary
what?
Death.
Yeah. I have cut to the quick. You know, you accuse me of being polarizing, and I wanted to show you I turned over a new leaf. And then, in keeping with the common perception of Easter, I was basically a department store bunny. You know, I was basically gathering eggs in my basket and wandering about giving them to the children. Children everywhere who on Easter expect eggs and chocolates and marshmallows. And the children, you know, on Easter are just so happy. And I think that that's a feeling that adults should have, that all of us should try to regain that wonderful feeling from childhood when we would run to the door and open it, and instead of milk bottles, there would be a basket of Easter delights. Life can be like that all the time. All you have to do is wish upon a star. All you have to do is follow the rainbow. It's as simple as that, really.
You're literally the Antichrist right now.
What are you
on
saying?
On Easter Sunday, for you to shovel this down our throat.
I'm offering an alternative.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. That's why you're the Antichrist right now. Your alternative is God-forsaken.
Listen to yourself. Godforsaken, indeed. It's life affirming.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. It's positive thinking, consciousness raising. And yet, not New Age tripe either, because it involves wonderful traditions like Easter lilies and new hats.
Okay, don't degenerate into that again. I've cut you off from that twice. Okay, we're not gonna go there again, Charles.
I don't understand what you dislike so much.
No,
it's a message of Easter goodwill.
You're sick.
What a horrible thing to say. I'm celebrating Easter.
You're completely out of control right now. Get a grip, Charles.
You mean a grip?
Have a modicum of self-control right now.
All right. I'm gripping very, very hard, right? Like they're the handles of two Easter baskets.
Don't.
Each filled with chocolate goodness.
Subjugate your mind right now. Subjugate your mind.
I don't see why I should. I think if you would just see things my way, your whole life could change. In ways that would make everyone around you severely uncomfortable. Oh, think of it. Think of going to work and say to your boss, hello. All you really need is a soft, faraway look in your eyes. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. There's a little too much in the way of Easter eggs.
You're like full-fledged, like Heath Ledger Joker right now in your own way. You know, where you're doing this sadistic thing, and you've got this laugh that's just out of control, but so.
But I'm trying to help. Why does no one see I'm trying to help? Oh, it's Easter. Easter under lockdown. What am I supposed to do?
Be a decent human being.
Oh, yeah. Like, that's going to help. Let me tell you something. If I was ruled by decent human beings, I'd be one. But I give my masters what they give me. So there. Oh, if only I could give it to them real up close and personal. What I wouldn't do. Oh, Your Excellency. I just think you're the most wonderful person that ever lived. Oh, and you know, it wouldn't even matter if I said it with a straight face or not.
Okay, well, I literally, I don't know where we go from here.
Oh,
where,
I do.
Where do you want to take the show, Charles? I'm leaving it in your hands. Well actually, firstly, maybe that's the worst thing I could possibly do.
Oh, come on. I've got the Easter Bunny's paw as a good luck charm. Do you know?
You cut off his paw?
It's not my fault. It's a good luck charm. Lucky Rabbit's foot. He was the closest thing available.
That's horrible.
After my brother fed him that scotch, he passed out. We got him a prosthetic. It's not like he's not going to be able to bring eggs next year. What? All right. Stop. Obviously, once again, a course in logic is necessary. All right, you ready?
Ready.
All right. Major premise: rabbit's feet are lucky.
Okay.
Minor premise: the Easter Bunny is the most extraordinary rabbit of all.
Okay. So an Easter
Conclusion.
bunny. Okay, yeah, go on.
Conclusion. So the Easter Bunny's foot is the luckiest of all.
That's true. I guess it's the most epic magic or lucky charm that you could have.
Now, mind you, it obviously didn't do him any good. It wouldn't have passed out with all the scotch and, been unable to escape getting his foot cut off. But we did get him a very nice prosthetic. So he'll be around next year. He'll lay eggs just as he does every year. And I will tell you that when my brother and I were little, my parents had a friend who was a composer named Elmo Russ. Now, this is an Easter story that's guaranteed to warm your heart. You look up Elmo Russ. He was a very well-known composer. And he taught my brother and me a little kid's song for Easter. He taught it to us, and one night my parents came home from the play, and we sang it to them for Easter. It's very short.
Okay.
It goes, "Don't throw rocks at the rabbit, or he'll bring rotten eggs home to you."
Okay.
Isn't that sweet?
That's interesting.
My parents thought it was darling when we sang it. They thought it was very cute.
Well.
I see you're having some problems with the whole Easter thing.
I'm having problems with the whole. I'm having pr problems with your approach to Easter.
Approach to Easter.
Yeah.
Well, what's wrong with my approach to Easter? I'm embracing it.
It's entirely lacking. It's not Christ-centric at all.
Who?
Exactly.
Let me tell you something. Easter is about America in springtime.
How so?
All right. Let me explain. This great nation of ours is covered with many forests, fields, prairies, and in almost every single environment, including the suburbs. Do you know what all those places have?
What?
Bunnies.
Okay.
Lots of bunnies. There are probably more bunnies per capita in the United States of America than any other country, except maybe Australia, where they're an introduced pest and they try to poison them. Now, I'm going to tell you something, smart guy, about bunnies. Don't you think the Rose Parade is the biggest thing that goes on in our part of the world?
The Rose Parade?
The Rose Parade on New Year's Day.
The biggest thing that goes on in our part of the world?
The San Gabriel Valley of Los Angeles County, California. Wouldn't you say
Okay,
that?
I would say that.
Okay. Now, who invented the Rose Parade? Who started it?
I don't know who.
The Valley Hunt Club.
Okay, what does that mean to me?
What it means to you, what did the Valley Hunt Club, who are still around, by the way, although they don't hunt anymore, what did the Valley Hunt Club hunt?
What did they hunt?
Bunnies.
Exclusively?
Well, jackrabbits. which are actually hares and not rabbits at all, but never mind. So the point I'm making is that the biggest thing in your part of the world you owe to bunnies, and you have the audacity to deny them the recognition they deserve at Easter. I think you should check yourself. You should question how attached you really are to your native place. I think there are loyalty issues here, really.
You know, next to the San Gabriel Valley, well, not exactly next, so there's the San Gabriel Valley, then there's the valley.
The San Fernando Valley.
The San Fernando Valley, and then there's Conejo Valley. Do you know what Conejo
means
in Spanish?
It means rabbit. See?
And there's a lot. It's there rightfully are. Named that, because there's
See?
A ton of them.
Have you ever had rabbit?
No. Is it good?
Do you ever... It's delicious, except at Easter time.
Why?
Well, at Easter, when the bunnies lay eggs at Easter, and it does something to the taste of the meat.
This is getting ridiculous. I don't even know what to say anymore. Just look at you blankly.
You didn't know that bunnies laying eggs affects the flavor of their meat? All right, let me ask you a question. Have you ever heard of egg-laying rabbits being offered for sale? Of course not, because it affects the flavor of the meat. I'm telling you.
I feel like I'm like a clown at a rodeo when, you know, like there's like a bull that's just rampaging and like you can't really control it, but you can kind of just run around and be like, don't go over here, don't go over here. I feel like that's my job right now.
Well, you know why.
Why?
How many Easter eggs did you have today?
None.
See, that's why. That's the problem. That's the problem. You know, years ago, there was a cartoonist named Kleban. And Kleban did a cartoon I've never forgotten. It showed a very pimply-faced looking kid with kind of a stupid look on his face, just sitting there. I forget his name. It was Bob or Cliff or something. I'll say Cliff, but I don't remember really. And next was a mound of headless chocolate bunnies. And the caption was, Cliff lived in Vermont, where he ate only the heads off chocolate bunnies.
It's pretty random.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought it was. Yeah, of course you do. I thought it was very random.
Well, it's one of the most satisfying things is biting the heads off of chocolate rabbits, and we used to have Peeps, biting the heads off of Peeps. I don't know. There's just something very satisfying about it.
There is. Children are cruel.
I guess so.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. But no, I realize you want to return back to something approaching sanity. I'm not saying you're a bad person.
Okay.
What I am saying is that you feel the need to somehow restore some kind of sanity. And I don't mind going there, but I will say that we are doing an Easter show in the third week of captivity. Now, think about that. This is our special Easter program. We should have bunnies galore, and there are none. We have no bunnies in front of us. None. Zippo. And you know why?
Why?
Oviparous bunnies are carriers of the coronavirus.
What?
Oviparous, that is egg-laying. Oviparous bunnies are carriers of the coronavirus. That's why they've been banned.
That is not...
It's not what?
That is a lie. There are no oviparous bunnies, and they aren't banned because they carry the coronavirus.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you seen any since the coronavirus broke out?
Oh, gosh. This is like... this reminds me of... an episode long, long time ago where we're talking about the unicorns, and it's like, oh, you ever seen a unicorn? And then I say no.
Well, there you
and
are.
Then, and then you basically blame the Jews for committing a unicorn holocaust. And there's all this blood of the unicorns.
Yes. It's all true. And now, because of the growth of the coronavirus, spread through oviparous bunnies, they've been banned at Easter time. I mean, honestly, this is as bad as Christmas without Christmas trees. Imagine if we tried to do a Christmas special without a Christmas tree. Exactly. Or a Halloween special with no jack-o'-lantern. No, it's not going to fly. But here it is. No oviparous bunnies because they've been banned.
Okay, so what should we do? I don't know what to do.
Well, I think what we need to do are the memes of production.
We don't have any. There's no memes of production today, Charles. No one sent in any this week. I'm sorry.
I sent you something.
You sent me something? I have to do this now?
No, you don't.
I'm not going to.
You're in
do
charge.
This,
you do what you want. You don't have to take my guff. You are the president of the corporation. You know what? You've got to stand up to me. I'm sick and tired of your taking this kind of guff. You show me who's boss.
All right. You know what? We're going to go ahead and do this. Charles, we're going to do impromptu. Charles, send me your meme through Facebook right now. And I'm going to get this meme of this picture, this insane picture.
It's not insane.
This thing we were talking about during the pre-show. Of this obscure show Charles likes.
I didn't say I liked
gravitated toward this random thought. All right, let's do this, Charles. Let's go. Go ahead. Send it to me through Facebook. You know what? I don't care about the audience. We don't care about the audience at all. We're going to subject them to this. So let's go ahead and do it. Let's do it, Charles.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, one thing I have to explain, and it does require some explanation, as life does as a rule. This is from a movie that I really cannot recommend called Blue Velvet. There's a scene in it where Dean Stockwell is in his apartment surrounded by, for want of a better word, dumpy chicks who are just kind of there. They don't really have a purpose. They're just hanging out along for the ride. Why do I mention this? The reason is that earlier on in the pre-show, I pointed out that whenever I hear the phrase, that the church has to accompany us. I think of these chicks from the movie Blue Velvet accompanying Dean Stockwell on his faith walk.
Okay, so I've got... You've transferred me the image. I'm going to put the image on the screen right now. There it is. It's on the screen. It's in the middle. You've got these...
Now this...
Okay.
Now, this is a meme of production which probably ought not to be nationalized. Okay. It should be kept in private hands.
So this came up as in the pre-show. By the way, an hour and a half pre-show where we're just rambling and just being incoherent. I mean, if you guys want content, if you guys are hungry for content, wow. We really
if you want to see us going incoherent, you want this pre-show.
Okay, so... I don't know. We were talking about the bishops, and somehow the bishops not doing anything and talking about accompanying.
Yeah, they're not
this image of.
They're not giving us the sacraments. You asked me, "Well, what are they doing?" I said, "Well, they're accompanying us."
Yeah.
And then when I said when I thought of accompanying, that made me think of the chicks in Blue Velvet who are accompanying Dean Stockwell. They're just sort of there.
So these
they
are
have
the
no purpose.
Right, yeah, the bishops
they're like
are
the
like
bishops.
These women. They're
Dean Stockwell is like the laity, the faithful.
Yeah.
And then the dumpy chicks are like the bishops. They're not really doing anything. They're just kind of hanging out, you know, just sort of there. Yeah, right, okay. Because, you know, we don't get sacraments. We don't get anything. I mean, mind you, there's some bishops that aren't like that, to be specific, to be fair. But especially when you've got bishops who have even banned the last rites. I mean, what are you even here for? What are you bothering with? So, again, the answer comes down from on high. We're accompanying. Okay. All right. So that makes me think of the dumpy chicks accompanying Dean Stockwell in Blue Velvet. There. Well, that wasn't that hard, was it?
No,
Makes sense.
it's actually useful because it got you speaking, actually saying things w which are designed to make a point at least. So we're moving in the right direction.
Oh, you want me to move toward polarization? You want me to polarize?
Okay, yeah, sure. Yeah.
You want me to bring division to the people?
It's our natural state. Chaos, disorder, and disruption.
Not joy and
No.
unity and closeness and bunnies and
Don't go
unicorns.
there. Don't go there. We've been doing a good job. Now let's stay on the track.
Right, well, we got that meme out of the way, so
Yeah.
you can send it off to wherever bad little memes go. You've been a bad meme. You've got to be punished. So send it off to wherever bad little memes go. And let's think of something entirely different, to wit. All joking aside, just for the moment, it has been, as you see, and it is taking a toll on our respective sanities. We have had a good time under lockdown, but it is Easter, ladies and gentlemen. Not only is it Easter now, Easter Sunday, when we're recording this, tomorrow, when you'll be seeing it, is Easter Monday. And there is Easter Tuesday. And frankly, all of Easter week and the Easter octave, and indeed, we are in Easter tide. Just as Christmas has a good chunk of the season, so does Easter. And Easter is actually, much as it pains me to say it, Easter is a more important feast even than Christmas, which is only number two. Easter is the holiest day in the church year because our Lord was born in Bethlehem precisely that he might die and rise again. Christmas is the beginning of the story. Well, actually, the Annunciation is, but you get the idea. But Easter is the fruition. And in his rise, we all rise if we're faithful to him. And even if the bishops right now are just sort of sitting around and we're playing Dean Stockwell, even then, they play their part, even if they don't believe it. Because we do need the sacraments, ladies and gentlemen. And I assure you, none of us who have gone through this time will really, I think, if we're believers, I don't think we'll ever take the sacraments for granted ever again.
You know what just hit me? And this is, we're kind of, we talked about this so much during the pre-show in that hour and a
Yeah.
half, but it just got me another thought where, so this is a hardship, but, and like all hardships, you can go in either direction,
Yeah.
right? Like perhaps, the death of a father. You can either, drink yourself to death or, let it all go, or you can honor his memory and try to aspire to be like him.
No.
And the same is true with I think the coronavirus time. I think people who love the sacraments, who love God, who are of goodwill, this hardship will push them closer to God in a way, in terms of use this time to value the sacraments more, to understand the value of the sacraments, to not take it for granted, to not presume as much. Whereas people, unfortunately, who perhaps might have been on the way out the door, this is going to help them.
This will help them right out. And it will also, as I mentioned in the pre-show, but I believe it will significantly weaken the authority of the bishops. As certainly of those bishops who were perceived as simply shutting everything down, especially in those dioceses where even the last rites had been forbidden. Now, when you consider the great pains that certain government officials in different parts of our country and elsewhere have gone to keep the abortion mills flowing, and yet churches are closed. One can go argue back and forth about whether or not this or that given bishop was correct in whatever strictures he had in restricting church activity. One might have shut down the churches, but you could have drive-through confessions, or they made a point of doing live masses. And the priest coming out and giving communion, or doing masses in the open air. I mean, different people have done different things. But, and then of course, there's just closing them up entirely. But any diocese where even the last rites are forbidden, any diocese that exists in an area where there are restrictions on church entrance, but the abortion mills are going, there's no excuse for the civil leadership, and there's no excuse for any bishop who doesn't jump up and down about it. And the other point I made during the pre-show is that all of my favorite restaurants in LA and New York and elsewhere, almost all of them, are doing everything they can to get their wares to their clients because they believe, like any good chef does, that what they produce is absolutely essential to their clients, and of course, essential to them too. And they're getting—I mean, I could never have believed not only that there would be, you could go to the Tam O'Shanter or the Tay and get delivery meals, but bars are giving cocktails to go right now. And I'm not against that by any means, I'm certainly not against keeping either or both liquor stores and tobacco stores open. I'm not against that at all. But what I'm saying is, how is it those things are essential, but our masters in church and state don't think sacraments are essential?
Yeah, this really highlights their lack of belief in the necessity of sacraments, right?
Yeah, it does. Well, I mean, it does for the religious leadership. For the political leadership, it shows how little the church actually means to them.
Right.
I mean, obviously, the liquor store owners, the restaurant owners, etc., as a group, are in a position to force our masters to listen to them. But the bishops, not so much. And they don't have the interest either.
I really love your drive-through confession idea.
Well, it's not mine. And, my godson does it. He's a priest. And there are a number of people who do that. There are a number of really, really remarkable and ingenious ways that people are trying to get the sacraments to their flocks. And of course, there's the live streaming, which I think, is certainly great. Live streaming the mass in the church onto an outside screen. And then whoever's out there, the priest comes out and gives them communion in dis you know, he's wearing a mask
Yeah.
and they're widely dissipated. That's no more a danger to the public health than any of the other things that are still being done. But that's only done by people who think, as do liquor store owners, as do restaurant owners, etc., that what they're doing is absolutely essential. And I think, again, with the abortion mills in the background, I think that we're going to have to ask our leadership in both church and state, when this is passed, some really searching questions, and I also have to ask, why are the medical personnel in those abortion mills that are functioning? Why are they still killing babies when they should be fighting the coronavirus? We need nurses in the hospitals. We need doctors.
Yeah, what's that metaphor? I can never the Nazi metaphor. The You couldn't remember last time, the other shows.
Well, I don't remember it now.
When the Germans were losing and
I don't know. That was I remember. That was when the Soviets were closing in on Budapest.
Yeah.
And Hungary was run. They'd gotten rid of the Nazis had gotten rid of Admiral Horthy. They'd overthrown him, the Germans had. Replaced him with a sort of puppet government. But even the puppet government wasn't made up of total insane morons, you know. And Eichmann was sent to Budapest to direct the rounding up of the Jews while the Soviet troops are closing in on the city. And he's using troops that could probably have been better employed fighting the Soviets.
Yeah.
He's using them to round up Jews. So the foreign minister of the Hungarian puppet regime goes in to see him. And he says just that. You know, Herr Eichmann, don't you think that really the troops would be better used at the defenses of the city fighting the Soviets? And he said, no. This makes the hunting of the Jews all the more important. That's just crazy.
The insane and obsessive attachment to pure evil, to murder.
Well, that's all the more important. It's what we say in Yiddish is meshuga, crazy, nuts, verrückt. And these people are mad, absolutely mad. All medical personnel doing something like that should be fighting the virus. If it's that bad. But if it's not that bad, then why are the churches closed? Mm-hmm. So anyway, questions. And speaking of questions, I'll bet you have some.
Nope, that'll do it for this episode.
All right. Okay. This has been a wonderful episode, one that's been personally very fulfilling. An episode that has made me think of rainbows and unicorns. Want to ask questions, or do you want me to go on like
no,
this?
No, okay, wait, okay, so...
It's up to you. I don't want to force you to do anything you don't want to do.
Okay.
I want you to feel completely comfortable. I want you to
all
feel
right.
at rest.
All right. I'm...
It's up to you. I don't want to tell you what to do. You're the boss.
Gosh, Charles. Okay. All right, shameless plug, of course. We need more subscribers to our YouTube channel. So if you want to subscribe, hit that button at the bottom right corner of your screen. If you like us, then click like. Sign up to Patreon for more content. Get your questions asked. We had the week prior, our pre-show was an hour long. This one was like an hour and a half long. Lots of funny stuff. Sign up. Okay, on to the questions.
One question before we do that, and I think it's an important one. Now, and this was a question that was sent directly to me. So do you see how you are? Do you see how you are? You're thinking this is a setup. You are? No, I can tell. You think this is some kind of a setup? Well, it's not, smart guy. Here's the question. Are you ready?
I'm ready, Charles.
All right. Somebody orders two books from you. The total is $28.
Well,
do they get free shipping and handling?
That's right, Charles. Free shipping and handling on all orders over $25.
Wow.
Limited time offer while supplies last. No COD. Void where prohibited.
Not an actor.
Not an actor.
Operators are standing by. I don't know what they're doing. Maybe they're accompanying. You know what? I'll bet those chicks with Dean Stockwell were standby operators. That's probably what standby operators look like.
Probably.
Well, there's a mystery solved. All right, what's our first question?
All right, our first question... Oh, gosh, you're going to love this question. Okay. Our first question is from Joseph.
Joseph!
All right, now control yourself on this question. Yeah. Okay. All right, now Joseph asks, what are the origins of the Easter Bunny?
Well, I'm really glad you asked me that question. The Easter Bunny was born a long, long time ago. His parents were Mother Nature and Father Time. And they loved each other so much that. What? You see the look on your face? You see the negativity that you're demonstrating on Easter? Children all over America and the planet are looking to you as a positive guide, and you're raining on their parade as we speak. All right, fine, be that way. Mr. Grinch here wants me to tell you that the Easter Bunny was originated as a figure of Germanic folklore. Fine, are you happy? A symbol of fertility. He was actually originally not a rabbit at all, not a bun bun, but a hare.
What's the
And it was
difference?
called, well, I'm glad you asked that question. The bunny, they're related slightly, and they're vaguely similar, but you know what a jackrabbit looks like.
What?
Long ears,
Yeah.
long legs,
Okay.
it's not a cottontail. They're vaguely similar because of the shape of the ears and the head. But the bunnies have small limbs. They've got little bunny cottontail tails,
Okay.
And they're kind of fluffy and very tasty.
Well, that's
Jackrabbits, on the
okay.
other hand, hares, much more athletic, bigger, big ears. And the interesting thing too about them is that they're born differently. No, I'm not saying that. I'm not talking about egg laying. That's totally different. Smart guy. You have to bring up. There's no such thing as oviparous bunnies. Where'd you get that idea? Anyway, the point is that when rabbits are born, they're blind and naked. Like mice.
Yeah.
But when hares are born, they're covered with fur and their eyes are open. That's one of the other differences. But I mean, our jackrabbits that we call jackrabbits in around LA and so on, they're hares, they're not rabbits. And then we have rabbits, of course, that are all over the place. And originally it was the Osterhase, the Easter hare. But in any case, because they both reproduce rapidly, they were considered images of fertility.
By Germanic,
They're by Germanic tribes. So eventually the Easter hare became a figure of German and Dutch folklore. And as we know, when the Dutch came to New York, New England, which in so many ways established the American mindset, the New England Puritans were very much against any of the church festivals. So they banned Christmas, they banned Easter, they banned Pentecost. And the Dutch in New York embraced all three. So our Easter eggs and our Easter bunny and all that actually come to us from the Dutch. The way Santa Claus comes to us from the Dutch. Oddly enough, Pentecost probably would have similarly survived as a civil holiday, except that amongst the Dutch, it became primarily identified with the blacks, who they called it Pinkster. And because it became such a heavily black holiday, the Dutch whites in New York stopped celebrating it. Such are the peculiarities of history.
Okay, I want to touch on something. Let's take it on a tangent, as we did in the pre-show.
Oh no, not a
So
tangent.
you mentioned that we owe the Dutch a lot.
Yeah. The Dutch in New York a lot. Yeah. We sure do.
And then you talked about cookies in
Cookies. There is,
general.
yeah, the reason why we use the word cookie, which is a Dutch derived word. I mean, the English call them biscuits. And they have other names for what we call biscuits. But what they call biscuits, we call cookies. And they always call them biscuits. But in America, in American English, we adopted the Dutch word.
So, are Dutch only responsible for the word or the actual culinary achievement?
A bit of both, a bit of both, because their cookies they made very, very popular, and they were very tasty. The English biscuits weren't quite as sweet, I don't think. I could be wrong. We'll have to ask the Julia Childs in the audience to correct me. But I believe that the Dutch cookies were sweeter than English biscuits. And they became a part of American culinary lore and linguistic lore. The other, well, we get several words in the Dutch, but another one of them that's very, very important in New York and everywhere else, it's a word you hear constantly from your slavish minions in the Tumble House Tower, which is boss. That is a Dutch word. They spell it BAAS. We spell it BOSS, boss.
Okay. Interesting.
And yeah, and that's a Dutch word. So the New York Dutch really gave us an awful lot.
Wait, wait.
And
Oh, okay.
well, they gave us Martin Van Buren and the two Roosevelts.
Okay. Yeah, Roosevelt's. Whatever happened to the Dutch? I mean, I don't. They're not a they're not very prevalent in America.
What do you mean?
I mean, I don't know anyone that's Dutch personally.
Actually, you do. There are a
Oh.
lot of Dutch. If your question is what happened to the New York Dutch,
Yeah.
on the one hand, they got severely assimilated over a long period of time. Remember that they came to New York in the 1620s, and they were conquered by the English 40 years later. But interestingly enough, Dutch did not become completely extinct in the New York, New Jersey area. I mean, native Dutch, I'm not talking about immigrants. The native Dutch language did not become extinct until about 1905.
I see.
So, I mean, Theodore Roosevelt's grandmother spoke Dutch, and he was very proud of being Dutch. There's that. The other thing, too, is that there were a number of Dutch Indonesian immigrants to the LA area after the fall of the Dutch East Indies, when they became independent as Indonesia. And you know who the most famous of those immigrants were?
Of the Dutch Indonesians?
Yes. To the LA area.
Know.
The Van Halens. I knew the Van Halens slightly when they were a garage band in the valley.
Yeah, they were right over here. Yeah.
Yeah, and now, mind you, we're going back, God help us, almost 50 years. But I remember many, many years ago, maybe about 35 or so years ago, when I, or even longer, when my former roommate in college came out to see me in LA. We were in one of my favorite bars in the Valley about, oh, 6 a.m. or something like that. It was early. And Eddie Van Halen came in and he said, "Hi, Charles, how are you?" And Brian was shocked that Eddie Van Halen knew me. Now, mind you, that was the last time I've seen Eddie Van Halen. I don't know he would know me now. But that Brian's never forgotten that particular incident. But it was only because they were, I mean, I had known them when they were a garage band.
Yeah. What's your favorite song?
I didn't say I was a fan.
No,
No, I mean, it really wasn't my kind of music. I mean,
I
I'm,
know.
you know, it, it, now if you ask me about Glenn Miller, now that's a whole other kettle of wax.
Yeah.
But at any rate, so the Dutch, they had a great deal of influence on New York, and as a result, on the country as a whole. And their descendants of the Dutch, the Holland Danes, and the Holland Society are very socially, and the St. Nicholas Society are still very socially prominent in New York.
Okay. Next question is from Theo. To what extent do you believe the catastrophic Protestant and French revolutions were punishment from heaven for the wars amongst the baptized that plagued and scandalized Europe in the late Middle Ages and into the early modern period?
Well, they weren't blessings. And so, you'll hear a lot today, especially while we're locked down with the pandemic, that, oh, God doesn't punish people for doing things like this. He doesn't punish them this way. Well, all right, fine. Then you're saying he blesses them. Great. I mean, the truth of the matter is that those wars, amongst other things, doomed the Crusades. And remember, the only thing that allowed the Crusades to succeed to the degree that they did was Europe, Christian Europe, Christendom, pulling itself together and establishing for the nonce a semi-united front. It was the only thing. And it was the only thing that, to some degree, sustained the Crusader kingdoms. But more and more and more and more and more, the Christian nations of Europe began pursuing wars with each other and internal civil wars, like the Wars of the Roses, the Hundred Years' War, and so on and so on, the Guelphs and Ghibellines, and all the rest of it. And then, of course, the Great Schism, which was the ultimate scandal of this kind. I mean, on two levels, you could see it. You could see how the fissures in European society, and we're talking on a purely natural level now, opened the door for the divisions of the Protestant revolt. And that, in turn, for the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, the 30 Years' War, and the French and following revolutions. But at the same time, one could also see the hand of God in them as a punishment. I mean, very often, God's punishments toward us come in letting us feel the consequences of our own actions. Most things we in life we get away with. But every now and then, God lets what we do catch up with us.
Yeah, that's why I'm slow to ascribe the coronavirus to. I mean, well, God is controlling everything, but coronavirus is not a byproduct of some of the evils which we personally have created. Is that fair to say?
Well, we don't know that. We don't know the origin of the coronavirus. I mean, there are some who claim that it was manufactured in a Chinese lab. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if it isn't true. I don't know anything. I have no preference for theories. It wouldn't surprise me. I'll say that. And we have the kind of leadership we have. Now, they didn't happen by magic. We have the kind of bishops we have. And they're
The other
all of
reason
them.
why I don't like the comparison is, so what's the holiest century ever
The
that they say?
holiest?
Like 12th century, 11th century, with all the greatest saints that came out of it.
Oh, they would say probably the 13th. And that had a lot of horrible stuff going on.
Yeah, the Black Plague, right?
No, that was the 14th century.
Oh, 14th century, really? Okay.
1300s.
I don't know. To me,
The 13th century was they had the plague, and they had the Great Schism at the same time.
I see. So, I mean, was the plague a punishment? The Black Plague? I mean, could you argue that was? I mean.
Well, of course you could, and they did at the time. Again, they said it certainly isn't a blessing.
I mean, to me. I don't know if I said this in the pre-show or no, I guess I said this in the beginning of this show, where each trial is an opportunity.
Oh, it's always that, but so is the Black Plague. But you see, something could be many things at once.
Yeah.
It could be an opportunity. It could be a punishment. I mean, look, if you're bad, you steal something and you're sent to jail. Now, there are two ways you can go with that. You can either say, that probably wasn't a smart idea. I don't think I'm going to do that again. Or you can become a hardened criminal. And that depends on you.
That's.
Now, if you were living a bad life, you go to jail and you reform, guess what? That was a good thing.
I guess. I don't know.
But if you were leading a bad life, you go to jail, you become much worse. That was a bad thing. And both happen in jail.
I kind of don't like that metaphor in, when it comes to describing plagues, because you did it. And it's a natural, organic happening. Plagues, it's not like, oh, gosh, we let the frog population and the locust population really go.
No, so now we're it's really not. Paying. It's not. But you see, we're all doing other things. I mean, look at where this has hit us. It will hit us in the economy, but look what our economy is based on. And it certainly has hit us in the church with the sacraments.
Yeah.
Now, are the majority of us that call ourselves Catholic great believers and heroes of the faith? Or are we go along to get along people? So, honestly, I can't help but think that in a certain sense, this is indeed a punishment. And we will, like the metaphor you don't care for, like the prison, we will take it one way or we'll take it the other. Some people will get out of this that the church is pointless, that everything is a bit cray-cray, and they'll go their own way. Others will become much more concerned churchmen than they were before. More active. Because they'll ask themselves, why did the church fold up its tent and vanish? You may actually see some people who were not that active before become more active. But mind you, if they do, they'll kind of have kind of a chip on their shoulders. And that, too, the leadership will pay. I mean, if the majority, it's going to be very important for the civil leadership that at the end of the day, the majority of their subjects see what they've been put through as warranted. That's going to be very, very important, because if they don't, if they don't feel that the lockdown was worth it, they're going to be trouble.
How? What do you mean?
Well, anything from voting out the bastards, so to speak, in the next election to, shall we say, civil unrest.
What information would have to be disseminated, though, in order for that to happen?
Oh, that the whole thing could have been, if it entered the popular mind that the virus could have been dealt with effectively without bringing everything to a halt and ruining the economy and destroying people's jobs and livelihoods. If that notion, and I'm not even talking about whether or not it's true, because I don't know, but if that notion ever got out into the minds of a majority of people in a given place, it would be very, very difficult for the people on top.
I think that's too elevated. I think that's too high-level intellectual. It's like,
okay, let me reduce it for you. They took my job for nothing.
See, I still think that's too high level. It's like the things that elicit riots are like the Rodney King beating, where it's like you don't. There's no interpretation required. You just see it right there, and then you react. It's a reaction. Reactions create
a lack
riots.
Of food might do it.
See, whereas an interpretation isn't. It's kind of like a subtle, long thing, whereas compared to an emotional reaction, something that elicits a strong emotional reaction.
Well, this is what I'm talking about, though. It will be a strong emotional reaction if the majority of people in a given place think that what they were put through wasn't worth it. And, of course, depending on how much is lost. Obviously, you're right if life goes on again more or less the way it was before. But if you have a ton of people who are suddenly on welfare who used to have jobs that are living hand to mouth that didn't have to, and a catalyst of some kind, a rabble rouser.
Okay, see, there you go. All right, that's more like it. Because I don't feel it's got to be an event or an incident, not just some egghead professional saying, "Oh, well, according to my model, we didn't need to do this."
No. Nothing like you're right. Nothing like that. You'll need somebody with a big mouth and a persuasive tongue to say, "You see, these fat cats were living high in the Tumblr House Tower while we were starving, and they've got nothing for us. Nothing." Oh, you know, all the little contractors around the compound that you used to do business with, and you're not doing business with anymore, and they've all shut it. Those guys, yeah. Now, I'm not saying an electrified fence won't keep them out. I'm not saying Tyrone's shoot to kill orders aren't effective. You know, and as he says, no one ever complains, at least not a second time. But, you know,
okay.
I think it's a little harsh. Anyway, where are we?
Better safe than sorry.
That's right.
All right. Next question is from Adrian.
Yes, Adrian.
Can demons invoke the most holy name of Jesus Christ if it suits their purposes? I ask because Francisco Madero, the first president of Revolutionary Mexico, was a known spiritist who did everything under their guidance, including the launching of his political career. The spirits, or demons, often used his most holy name in their messages to him. Can they do that? Madero's assassination triggered one of the bloodiest time periods in the history of Mexico, and I wonder if demonic activity was behind all of it.
Well, I don't know about all of it. There's always demonic activity present.
We're talking about whether it's proper demonic or, you know, it's demonic influence, whether it's temptation or obsession or oppression or possession.
No.
Right.
No, so I'm sure there was some, as there always is in anything horrific.
Yeah.
We're told in scripture that the devil can quote scripture. Now, whether that means he can invoke the name of Jesus, I don't know. And I don't pretend to know.
What does it mean to invoke?
To invoke, to call up.
To just say. Although,
what's that?
I mean, how is it different than just saying?
Well, you could say anything. Invoking, you mean to call someone to you.
Called, okay.
So, and of course, interestingly enough, there's invoke and evoke, and those are two different phrases.
Yeah.
Invoke means you're asking something to come forward. Evoke is to try, is to force it to come forward.
Well, maybe it's like when people swear or take the Lord's name in vain.
Maybe.
You know, because that's...
It could, and I mean, and they certainly blaspheme.
Yeah.
Now, whether they can... I, you know, it's a good question. It's not one I can answer.
Yeah. All right. Next question is from Patrick.
All right.
What do you think of the Basilians? Do you feel it's a useful and noble religious order?
Yeah, sure. They do a lot of work. I mean, there are several different varieties, but they do a lot of work with the Eastern Rites, especially the Ukrainians and Ruthenians. Yeah, sure.
Anything else about the Basilians? That was a pretty quick answer.
No, I mean, there's not much to say. They have been tremendous missionaries for the church, the Eastern Rites of the church. But they come in different batches, and the different batches, some of them have problems, some of them don't. You know?
Okay.
And there are Western Rite Basilians, whom I don't know that much about.
Next two questions are from Brian.
Hello, Brian.
Charles, what do you think about Richard II? Supposedly, he was a tyrant, but I think that is largely because he actually wanted to rule and not be dependent on Parliament for tax money. As to be expected, his deposition only made things worse in the long run, as it eventually caused the Wars of the Roses.
No, well, I think that's true. I agree with you. And he's also the one who first consecrated England as Our Lady's Dowry, which consecration was just renewed. Richard the Third, or Richard the Second, rather, was also the fellow who, in Shakespeare's play of the same name, Richard the Second, he puts the speech into his mouth: "For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and talk about the death of kings." It's quite an evocative. It's some of my favorite, one of my favorite lines in Shakespeare. Because of course Richard the Second was in fact overthrown. I agree with Brian with his reading of the thing. Let me see if I can conjure up from the vasty deep the phrase, the line I want, which is so evocative. Let's see. It looks like I've got it. What do you know? I feel good about myself and my choices as a human being. Here, let's see. It's in hiding, but I will find it. Ah, here it is. "For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings. How some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed, some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping killed, all murdered. For within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king, keeps death his court, and there the antic sits, scoffing his state and grinning at his pomp, allowing him a breath, a little scene, to monarchize, be feared, and kill with looks, infusing him with vain self and vain conceit, as if this flesh which walls about our life were brass impregnable, and humored thus, comes at the last, and with a little pin, bores through his castle wall, and farewell, king." That is Richard the Second, Shakespeare. Whether or not he actually said anything like that, who knows? But it's certainly an evocative meditation upon the state of kingship and rulership in general.
Right. Next question from Brian. Can you please explain the old calendar where there were doubles, greater doubles, and semi-doubles?
Well, the doubles refer to the, if I remember correctly, they refer to the Vespers. In a double, for a double, you had first Vespers were the night before the feast, which was only for major feasts. And then semi-doubles, there would be a commemoration of the coming feast, but the whole Vespers would not be given up to it. And what's the other again?
Semi-doubles?
No, so the semi-doubles, as I say, they had a commemoration of the coming feast.
Greater doubles.
Greater doubles, I think, and I could be wrong, and I'm sure that somebody in our audience will correct me if I am wrong, which I could be. But as I say, I believe it refers, the doubles had two sets of Vespers, the night before and the morning, and that night of the feast. It's like All Saints' Day, for instance. But in a super double, those preceding Vespers would be only having to do with that great feast. In a double, the Vespers of the day and the Vespers of the feast would be sort of side by side. A semi-double, there would simply be a commemoration of the feast in the Vespers. I think that's the truth. And again, someone will correct me if I'm wrong. But to give you an example, on All Saints' Day, All Saints' Night had the Vespers of All Saints' Day were immediately followed by the first Vespers of All Souls. They were side by side. And this was very strange because the second Vespers of All Saints is very joyous, but the first Vespers of All Souls is very somber, the Vespers of the Dead. So you make this immediate transition, and it's very peculiar if you see it done properly.
Okay, next question is from Jody. I'm a history major and have an interest in the first American Civil War, the Revolution. I've heard Charles talk about George Washington being the most Catholic president. If you would, go over the policies that separated him from Jefferson and the more deistic founding fathers in a Catholic way. Also, do you think the title of president could be one of the many titles that a hypothetical American monarch would assume, or would it be abolished entirely?
Well, those are two very different things. I have said he's the most Catholic, partly because there's a good deal of evidence that he died Catholic, but also he abolished Guy Fawkes Day with the forces. He rendered a number of interesting services to the Catholic population. The Pope asked him if he had an appointment he wanted for the first Catholic bishop. And he said, no, that's entirely your affair. Appoint whom you choose. So the Pope asked the best-known American of the time, Benjamin Franklin, for advice. And he recommended John Carroll. But Washington was, of course, opposed to the French Revolution, which Jefferson was sort of friendly toward. So stuff like that. How is he different from the deists? Well, he was more outwardly religious. He went to a lot of different churches in the Washington area. And just very much in general. But in truth, the difference wasn't all that great in terms of policy. And then the other question as to whether or not a future monarchy in America would retain the title of president, I don't know. Monarchies are funny with the titles they retain. For instance, the kings of Italy were funny, not because they were Italian, although that can be amusing, but what?
Go on.
Anyway. But because the kings of Sardinia, when they were dukes of Savoy, were given the title Perpetual Vicar of the Empire in Italy. Now, what was that empire? It was the Holy Roman Empire. But the Duchy of Savoy was a small area. It was, in fact, the Duke of Savoy was so conservative, so traditional, that he was the only Italian prince who insisted that he was still part of the Holy Roman Empire. And so they were given the title Perpetual Vicar of the Empire in Italy. All right, well, 1715, the Dukes of Savoy make themselves kings of Sardinia, and they keep the title. 1870, they conquer Rome. They become kings of Italy, and they keep the title Perpetual Vicar of the Empire in Italy. But the Holy Roman Emperor had abdicated in 1806, and most authorities declare that that was the year the Holy Roman Empire ended. It didn't matter to the House of Savoy, and they remain unto this day perpetual vicars of the Empire in Italy. Well, monarchies are like that. The King of Sardinia, the King of Naples, you know, that's the southern Italian kingdom. Mounts Naples and Bari and down. What? Anyway, them, the King of Spain and the Emperor of Austria, all claim the title King of Jerusalem. And there are reasons why each of them claims it, but that comes from the Crusader days. Up until 1802, because of the Hundred Years' War and the claims that they had had, the kings of Great Britain still called themselves kings of England, Scotland, France, and Ireland. So you see, these titles, I don't know, maybe. My mythical king did not, because it was obvious he wanted to make a break with the old regime. But if we ever did have a monarch in this country, who knows? I don't.
He did not what? He did not abolish it, right?
Well, the title of president was abolished. Okay. He kept a lot of other things. He kept the flag.
Yeah, it's confusing because, he kept the
flag. He kept everything he could keep, you know. And I think I told you what was interesting for me when I was putting the character together was the flag. Because initially I thought, well, maybe he'd replace it with the Grand Union. But the problem is that the Union Jack in the corner was something the Jacobites never had. Because they didn't have the United Kingdom. And when Bonnie Prince Charlie invaded Scotland, the first thing he did was declare that the union between England and Scotland was abolished. So they would never have flown the Union Jack. So what would they have flown? Well, I thought about it. I thought about it. I said, you know, he'd probably keep the flag and literally wrap himself in it.
To me, as a marketing person, the flag is like a brand name.
You know, yeah.
It's like Google or Yahoo. It's an empty placeholder for your brand. And so yeah. To me, it would make sense that he keep the flag because, okay, this is what the United States are now.
Yeah.
You see?
And they're me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he was king not only of the United States, but of each state individually.
Yeah.
Which was another thing that was made a great deal out of in the book. You know, he is king in right of the United States and king in right of Texas, king in right of Indiana, king in right of Delaware. And one of the amusing points of the book, I thought, was that on the one hand, the original Constitution was restored to the point that although the king appointed the governors, the states could institute a state religion if they wished, or not. Although as long as civil rights were not impeded. And so if you recall, the first state to take advantage of this was Utah, which almost immediately made the Latter-day Saints the state church. And then I said, however, since that day, no Mormon has ever been appointed governor of Utah.
Yeah, of course.
Well, you see, checks and balances.
Mm. Okay. Next question is from Miranda.
Miranda.
What does Mr. Coulomb think of the purple scapular? I like the symbolism of it and the devotion to the wounds of Christ and tears of Mary. I'm not too sure about the whole 3 days of darkness bit.
Mr. Coulomb doesn't know anything about it. He's never heard of it. This is the first he's ever heard.
Hmm. Okay. Okay, then. Our last question for the day is from Theo.
Hello, Theo.
In 2005, Pope Benedict said in an interview that St. Anselm's atonement theory, the idea that God the Father willed Christ to die on the cross to repair the infinite offense that had been made to God, and in this way to restore the shattered order of justice, was incomprehensible to modern man. Please discuss. Is there some kind of block on modern man understanding the mystery of salvation?
Well, you know, I think a lot depends on the way in which the Pope meant it, and I don't know. Did he mean that the thing itself was too stupid for modern man to grasp because modern man is so brilliant? Or did he mean modern man is too stupid to catch on to something so basic? I don't know. But let's just put it this way. If there is some sort of a dispute between St. Anselm and quote-unquote modern man, I don't think the problem is with St. Anselm.
Yeah, it's hard to believe Saint, gosh.
Well, we've already canonized him. He'll be happy to know that.
Pope Benedict would say that.
I know people who know him. I'll let him know.
To me, I would especially assume that he's sort of criticizing modern man because it coincides with one of my favorite Bible verses, that the light shines in the darkness and the darkness did not comprehend it.
No.
So too with this, it's acknowledging the darkness of modern man not being able to comprehend the light.
And modern man has made himself dark.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, but there it is. You know, again, the fact that so many of us don't see a problem with churches being closed and abortion mills kept open. I mean, let that sink in. That's modern man. He doesn't see a difficulty there.
Well, you know, I think with everything, I think what modern man does is that I think modern man is jaded and he shrugs and he says, what can you do?
where you can get your face out of the trough.
But what does that require?
Well, it requires accepting yourself for what you are, firstly, recognizing that you've got a face at the trough.
Yeah, everybody else does. Yeah.
Yeah, but focus
But
on
not
you.
me.
Oh, I see. Well,
Yeah.
yeah, that's right. You tell him, boss. You let him know. You read that boy the right act. Him coming in here with all his unicorns and his marshmallows and his little bunnies. You let that boy know who's in charge here. You don't take none of that. No, I mean, honestly, the sad truth of the matter is that modern man is a very sad piece of work. And we all partake of it to some degree, of course. Yeah, I know we don't. We're wonderful, okay. But it's grim. It's grim.
Yeah.
And in all likelihood, unfortunately, we are going to need some smacking around before we wake up. I don't like that. And you know why I don't like it?
Why?
I'll tell you, one of the things about being something of an historian is that you know that world historic events are unpleasant to live through. Now, I had hoped, having reached my 60th year, that I might be able to crawl out of this life quietly, peacefully, comfortably, the way I've lived most of it. I mean, I've had a few unpleasant scrapes with reality, but most of my life has been fairly calm, fairly pleasant. It doesn't look like I'm going to manage that.
Don't count your chickens, Charles.
No, I won't. Yeah, but I've got so many of my contemporaries who checked out the past 5 years, and I'm still here. I've got a weird feeling I'm going to be made to see more than I may want to. It's just a feeling. I don't know if it's true. And so the only thing I can do while I'm here as a result is to make people feel better about themselves, to help them reach deep within to that corner of quiet, that inner peace that all of us have, if we're just willing to look deeply within and
Oh, gosh. Put me to sleep over here.
It seems to me that you find the quest for inner peace tedious. Oh,
Your version of the quest for inner peace.
Well, at least I haven't been polarizing.
Oh, that's true.
See, you accused me of being polarizing at the beginning of the show. Now you have to accept that I do, in fact, attempt to bring people together.
I think you're just punishing me for saying that you're polarizing.
No, I don't punish. No. I leave that
Oh.
to
Okay.
There was a movie years ago with a very lovely lady called Jean Tierney. But she, I forget the name of the character, but the name of the movie was Leave Her to Heaven. And she was this horrible, horrible woman. I mean, she was constantly causing trouble. She was something of a murderess. She was horrible. But leave her to heaven. You don't want you even though she wanted to murder the hero's 12-year-old boy by drowning him. That's just her way. You missed some of the great movies of our era.
All right, it's time for Book of the Week.
Oh, which is
Sin
by
Revisited by
Solange
Solange
Hertz.
Hertz. What is this? Now playing, or now showing, Revisiting Sin with the Desert Fathers and St. John of the Cross.
Indeed.
And this is sort of, we had the cover, we designed it in this way so that it looks like a sign a from movie. Sin City, Las Vegas. That was one of Solon Schertz's recurring talking points.
You know what it says.
What it says.
You know what they say about Vegas, rather.
What?
What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
That's right.
You know why?
Why?
Sin City.
Yeah. That's right.
And Solange did not think much of Vegas, I can tell you.
No, she did not. So, this is my favorite of Solange's books. This is a masterpiece. How did she say it? In Sin Revisited, Solon Schertz tackles the topic of sin with a unique perspective for modern times, delving into the intellectual approaches of the Desert Fathers, as well as St. John of the Cross. In her own words, don't expect to find the seven deadly sources so familiar in song and story. You'll find eight, and even these won't be in the same sequence most of us are used to. This approach is newer than Vatican II because it's so much older, if you know what I mean. Very much older, certainly, than the old Baltimore Catechism. And that's true.
Yeah.
Because the thing about the Desert Fathers, the Desert Fathers are kind of in. They're kind of in vogue now.
Yeah. I guess, well, people are looking for spirituality. And they certainly have it in abundance.
The defining characteristic, one of the defining characteristics of the Desert Fathers is they're very practical and pragmatic.
Yeah.
They're very hands-on. It's like, okay, you have this problem with gluttony. Okay, how do we fix this? We need to fix this.
And they go and to work.
So, let's go to work. So, and that's what this book offers. It offers how to tackle each sin. So, for example, for gluttony, there are three primary things to follow to beat that. Yeah. Number one, eat only at designated times.
Yes. See, no between meals, snacks.
People don't think that. Like, the capriciousness of eating and nibbling and snacking, eating whenever you want, is a form of gluttony. I think a lot of people don't think that. They just think the quantity.
No, it's not.
Eat what is set before you. Ooh, so what does that tackle? That tackles the pickiness. You know, I need to eat only the best stuff and it needs to be very sensuous. It's, you know, sort of, you know.
Well, it's also, well, I won't eat that.
Right. Right. So, and lastly, always leave the table with room for more. So that
meaning always go away hungry.
Yeah, a little bit.
We have the feeling that we need to go away stuffed.
Yeah.
It's not a real meal until you're basically waddling out of there, barely able to move.
Yeah.
Every day should be Thanksgiving.
And the other thing that I loved about it is how it shows you the interrelation of the vices. My favorite line in the book is, undue partaking of food leads to undue partaking of persons. You see? It's appetite.
It's appetite. And the interesting thing, the opposite is also true. Very often you'll find in Lent, if you keep Lent very strictly in terms of curbing food intake and types of food, you'll often find that, shall we say, other appetites fall off in severity.
Exactly. That's why it's always prayer and fasting. You know, it's not just prayer; it's fasting
and almsgiving.
And almsgiving, as some very as our local priest loves emphasizing that. But and I've always wanted to tell him, Father, that's a big conflict of interest.
I don't think he'd accept that easily. But
it's,
you know,
very
almsgiving,
true, though. I mean, we are I myself have had to improve my almsgiving. I don't think as a whole that, well, I know for a fact that we don't give 10%, and there is a study on it, actually, I think by Georgetown University, that it's more like 2%,
If that.
if that, you know?
And of course, during the pandemic, where, I mean, before you had the idea that you were kicking up something in return for something. Now it's just a question of kicking something up for nothing. But that's not your problem. And of course, if you don't feel like giving the money to the church, you can give it to other Catholic causes. You can give it to bums on the street. I remember when I was 12 or 13, something like that. I was walking with my dad, and this fellow comes up, a beggar, and dad gave him a buck. And as soon as this guy was out of earshot, I said, "Dad, how could you do that? He's just going to spend it on booze." I was a very censorious young man. And my father said, "Well, firstly, son, in the gospel, it tells us that almsgiving covers a multitude of sins. And unlike his oh so perfect younger son, your old father has a multitude of sins to be covered. Secondly, I'm not such a hypocrite that I would deny someone else something I enjoy myself. And thirdly, if you live the way that man does, you'd need a drink."
I've meditated on that because a local priest does that regularly. Like, there is, I guess, perhaps I heard a local bum who depends on it. And I was wondering about, should you do that? And I thought, I forgot where, how I arrived at the answer. I forgot who, how it came to me, who told me it, but it's, I felt the answer was it's not just for the bum, but it's
No,
for you.
it's for you.
It's a mortification
It's
that,
parting with.
you're not getting a return on investment. It's not going anywhere per se.
No, and this is not someone you need to curry favor with. The bum having a good view of you is not really going to help you. Although it's funny, there was a bum who was always on the corner just as you got off the freeway to go to Saint Philip's in Pasadena. So it was Hill Avenue. And he was there for years. And every time I would go to Mass with late lamented Brother Leonard Mary, I'd give this guy a buck. Well, it got so that if Brother wasn't with me, because he was sick or something, the guy would go, "Well, how's the old man?" And he said, "Oh," and he'd always say, "Oh, I'll pray for him." Well, and then the unfortunate time came when he died. I drove by there and I gave the guy his buck, and he says, "What is the old man?" I said, "Well, he died." He said, "You know what? Today, why don't you keep the buck?" Which was interesting.
I don't know how I feel about that.
Well, it was obviously his way of trying to.
It's interesting. I guess that's all he can do
It's all he can do.
as a way to help,
Show,
to show. That reminds me of a very random thing that I filed away for when I become a parent. It's a when it was kind of a beautiful little thing when like a child or daughter gives you a rock or something where they're just giving it to you and it's not really useful, but the picture was saying, talk, always accept what is given to you because that's the most that they can give. And you're also, but more importantly, you're teaching them to give. You're teaching them to love to give. And that's a very important lesson. So all you new parents out there, accept Except the little, you know, rocks or whatever your child is giving you.
That's crayon scrawl that they think is a picture of something.
Yeah.
You know, they appreciate that. And as you say, it's teaching them something. You know, it's funny. This is speaking of random, but, you know, the memories get pulled up. I remember it must have been 66 because we were newly ensconced at the Criswell building in beautiful Hollywood. And this was the height of the hippie era. So maybe it was 67. But there are hippies everywhere in Hollywood. And I was walking down the street. It was on Sunset. I was walking toward Blessed Sacrament. And this hippie chick came up to me. And she was wearing a long gingham dress like Melanie used to wear, the singer.
Okay.
But it wasn't Melanie, trust me. Anyway, she comes up to me, and she said very intently, "You're a beautiful little boy. You should have something beautiful. Take these." And she reached into her voluminous pocket in her skirt. She gave me a leather bag, and off she went, which I thought was kind of strange. When I opened the leather bag and I got home, it was filled with seashells that had been painted, had glitter affixed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That was it. It was a very hippie thing.
What do you think of that? Were you grateful? Did it make an impression on you?
Well, I remember it all these years later, so it sure did. The fact that some random chick out of nowhere would give me all these seashells because she thought they were beautiful. You know, I showed them to my dad. You know, he took a good sniff to make sure there were no drugs or a pot or something in the bag. But, you know, I told him what had happened, and after he stopped laughing, he said, "Well, for whatever reason, you made an impression on the girl."
Okay.
And, you know, as a six-year-old or whatever I was then, it didn't affect me quite the way it would have had I been older. But it was interesting. Hollywood was a random place. But speaking of random, you know, that was our last question. We are still face to face with the fact that we're on Easter Sunday on lockdown. Do you have any predictions? Is anyone saying anything as to when they might lighten up where you are?
Well, in LA County, they extended it until mid-May, the lockdown. I just read this too. The main doctor of the United States seems optimistic about how long it's going to be. And I guess last week or this past week, everyone's talking about how it's definitely having an impact. So I don't know. The curve's flattening, I believe. It's all about, you know, the questions that are people asking are now, what are the signs? Like, what has to happen? And so I guess it's all about getting, not protocols, but the tools or instruments in place to be able to handle, things. So I don't know. I in terms of the coronavirus thing, I think it's all going to be fine. I'm more worried about the economy afterwards, but the stock market doesn't seem worried at all. So that's good, I guess, for now.
What made me laugh was when Bernie pulled out of the race, the stock market surged. That's got to be, if I were Bernie, that would really be painful.
Nobody wants Bernie at a time like this.
Oh, come on.
Oh, you know, I've been sitting on a joke. Go ahead, let it out.
Let it out.
If I were Trump or if I were Biden, the ultimate campaign slogan. I mean, it's obvious, right? Because what do we all want?
Biden.
No, I mean, like, what is the thing that all of society wants?
Money.
But what does that entail?
Work.
Which is?
Annoying.
A return to normalcy.
Oh, yes, of course. We want a return to normalcy. Thank you, President Harding. You know, vote Republican in 22. Okay, great.
This goes back to our Warren G. Harding Memorial episode.
It sure does. And I think that Warren Harding will end up being seen as the prophet he was. I love throwing that out there. I really do. Warren Harding, ladies and gentlemen, was the greatest president of the 20th century. And it's time America sat up and accepted it. Why not? Could be true. I don't know. I wasn't there. I will say that here in Austria, the chancellor supposedly is going to announce some lessenings of the restrictions tomorrow.
Oh, great.
Yeah, well, I don't know what they're going to be, but they kept talking about the necessity of getting the growth of the virus down to 2% a week or something, and it's down below what they were looking at.
Yeah.
But, and here's the big but, they're going to, they say they want to loosen things very slowly to make sure that there isn't a sudden spike in numbers. And frankly, unless and until there is a readily available treatment for this thing, they may loosen up considerably here, but that doesn't mean they're going to open the borders. So I really, in answer to the question some of our readers have asked me, some of our viewers rather, I don't know when I'll be able to come home. I really have no idea. Maybe the summer. I don't know. I have no idea.
Okay.
And you know, the funny thing about that, I had a dream a few nights ago. And in my dream, I flew back to LA to do a lecture at a conference. And I was in my room at home, you know, at my house, what, 5 blocks from the compound.
Yeah.
And, you know, be on the other side of the tracks. And I was there in my little cigar box house. I was in my room getting dressed to go down to downtown LA to deliver a lecture at this conference on something or other. And it suddenly hit me all at once. Why in God's name did I do this? They won't let me go back to Austria. There's no way I can go back. Why did I do this? This was crazy. And I was just hitting myself for having come over to do the conference. Well, then I woke up. And you've no idea what a relief it was to know that I hadn't actually come back. I mean, don't take that as an attack on the land of the free and the home of the brave, but I was just so angry with myself for having gone home. And I didn't. And I felt, you know, I felt better. Hey, this is about Easter. It's about resurrections.
Yeah.
You know, it's about leaving the slough of despond and entering the heights.
Yeah.
Lest you fear that I'm going to go off into marshmallows, I'm not.
Good.
Instead, I'm going to remind you and everyone else that it really is Easter. And that it was Easter in 1915. It was Easter in the midst of the Black Plague. Easter is always Easter, as Christmas is always Christmas. We had a good question about how you keep Holy Week. Well, I'll tell you how you keep Easter, even if you don't have any sacraments and you don't have any church. You keep it as best you can. Because even if you're prevented from celebrating it the way you would like, you can celebrate it somehow, some way. Is Jesus Christ is truly risen today. And if you think that our Holy Week this year was bad, think of what his first Holy Week was like. Hmm. And he came through it, and so shall we. One year, I spent Holy Week and Easter in boot camp. Now, that wasn't so much fun, believe you me. But we found a way of commemorating it, even though we couldn't go to Mass.
Yeah.
And it was, but a bunch of us Catholics got together and we recited some prayers, sang some hymns. And I'll never forget that Easter. No, never will. And I won't forget this one either. And I'm sure none of our listeners and viewers will forget this Easter.
Yeah. It's one for the ages.
Yep. And of course, there's something else to bear in mind, too.
What?
Just as Santa can't be kept out, even though you don't have a chimney, no lack of eggs is going to repel the Easter Bunny.
Okay.
Feel better?
I feel great, Charles.
All right, well, let's go out on a happy note.
On that note, if it's Monday,
It's off the menu.
and the soul you save,
May be your own.
see you next
Happy
time.
Easter, gang.